Welcome to the Agency Profit Podcast, a show dedicated to going deep space on agency operations, which is just as nerdy as it sounds. I'm your host, Marcel Petipoff. I'm the CEO of Parakeeto, a firm that helps digital and creative agencies measure and improve their profitability. Join me as I interview some of the smartest thought leaders and agency owners in our space and go deep into operations, metrics, and all the other things you need to get right so you can spend less time worrying about operations and more time executing on your vision. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Agency Profit Podcast. I am pleased today to be joined by an old friend, Michael Wark, and he is tuning in from all the way on the other side of the planet in the future. It is tomorrow, 7 a.m. in Australia, and Michael has been in the financial services and in particular the accounting and CFO space for 19 plus years. Today, he runs Trimline and specializes in helping agencies get their house in order and optimize profitability, cash flow, and the valuation of their business. And so today, we're going to be nerding out over finance, agency finance, what could be better. So with that, Michael, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks, Marcel. Really excited to be here. I know we've had a chat, you know, previous years, and I love what you do, what you put out on the internet. So I'm excited to, I'm excited to have today's chat.
Yeah, me too. And so I guess before we get into it, let's explain to the audience what you do in your own words. Who do you help and how do you help them?
So I focus on helping agencies, plugging in as a fractional CFO or a virtual CFO. I've got a client base mainly here in Australia, but also do help a couple of clients, UK and stateside as well. And I kind of focus on, I think we're kind of, you're very operations focused, but you have a great accounting mind. I'm obviously accounting trained, but I love talking about operations. So we both have these superpowers that kind of meet in the middle, which I love. But I love the strategic piece of running a business, growing a business. How do you improve its profits? How do you get a team working together? And all those kind of forward focusing, big picture conversations is what I love doing with my clients. And that's what I do day to day.
Yep. And that's a big part of the reason that I think we became fast friends and that I'm excited to have you on the show today. And we're talking about a couple of things that we'll bring up later regarding just the nuances of books and charts of accounts not being correctly set up. So more on that later. But before we dive into that, I want to understand what led you to start Trimline and why focus on agencies? What led you to that point?
Yeah. So I was working at I started the career in big corporate, got my CA at Ernst & Young, worked in that big end of town for a number of years, but didn't have a lot of purpose and passion. So I joined a small business, helping small business owners, mainly online, but also a lot of agencies in that previous business. And Trimline evolved naturally out of my kind of desire to do advisory. That previous business was doing just online recurring bookkeeping. And so I kind of launched Trimline with the blessing of the previous founder, and I took all of the agency clients from that business because they were going to focus on e-commerce. So I kind of got off to a rolling start with a bunch of agency clients to begin. And the reason agency clients and why I love working with them is that they're my people. I love the conversations with them. I spent a lot of time working in the film industry, both here in the UK, and people with kind of a creative mind or kind of approaching problems with a marketing background, I feel like I really relate to. And on a personal level, I enjoyed working with those kind of founders. So it was a really good fit and I've built it from there.
Excellent. And so you've been at that for a number of years now. And I think that this is really important, right? So 4 years into running Trimline, prior to that, you were at Bean Ninjas. And I think one of the things we're going to talk about a little bit later on today is this idea of kind of taking a management accounting first approach. And I think that that's really important because if you don't understand the business model, it's really hard to set up a financial system that's going to make sense and to be able to actually support that business model. And this is something that I think both of us see a lot when we work with clients or we inherit clients from a very generalist or perhaps like a purely tax-focused accountant that is not spending the time or perhaps just hasn't positioned themselves in such a way where they can develop that deep strategic understanding of their client's business and really use that to inform the way that financial statements are set up. And so kudos for finding that niche and sticking to it.
No, I think the incentives for tax accountants is compliance, to look backwards, look back in time and make sure that is correct. But as you and I know, that's not how you grow a successful business. You need to be future focused, and I just genuinely enjoy that kind of stuff. I find the historical stuff, the compliance stuff, is really necessary, but it's not what lights me up.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not really what drives results. It's a convenient problem that hopefully you have at the end of the year, a really big problem that you're going to pay a whole bunch of tax because you're rolling in so much money, but that problem is created in a completely different set of insights. So with all of that, let's talk about the kind of core topic for today, which is really the stages of growth for a firm as they are on the route to 5 million and beyond. Let's talk through what those stages are in your mind and how you make sure that clients are set up to successfully navigate those, both in terms of their financials, but also in terms of their strategy.
Yeah. And I wrote an ebook on this last year, trying to unpick why people don't get to 5 million and beyond. The reason I picked 5 million is because generally you've got the budget to have a management team layer and you kind of have the systems and processes built to get you to 10, 15, and you've already kind of got those systems built. So that's why I focused on that first kind of portion of a business's journey. I tried to unpick why it was so hard. And really the whole purpose of doing that research was to work out which problems to solve and when to plug them in. Because I think for founders, there's a lot of shiny object syndrome. You don't know, you're not profitable, but there could be six different things to work on to help you with that. And depending on where you're at on the business growth curve, the priority order is a little bit different. So I tried to really make it a clear roadmap or pathway for what you should do when at each stage of growth. And, obviously building yourself out of the business, building a team is a big part of it. But what I found again and again, especially with clients who came in the door unprofitable, was that they didn't actually have visibility over their true business model, their actual profitability, their real P&L. And so they were making decisions based on distorted numbers, and they were always going to be stuck because they didn't have a clear picture of reality to help solve it first. And that was where I started.
So maybe we start there, which is, you know, what are some of the things that you've seen when clients come to you after having worked perhaps with other financial firms or perhaps doing it on their own that is holding them back from having the visibility that's required to make thoughtful decisions on the road to scale?
Yeah. So part of it is I gauge where the founder's at in terms of their own knowledge of accounting, of reading a P&L and reading a balance sheet. So if they're not, they don't have that, we start there and make sure they understand it. I don't try and be the one that has all the knowledge. I try and teach them and coach them into understanding their own business. The core ones often are how they're paying themselves from the business is a core part of it, whether they're taking owner drawings, they're pulling a wage out. That can get detailed, and often I found, especially in the early stages, people have a couple of good months and they'll take out more. They're feeling rich. They've been bootstrapping this thing for a while and they have a few good months, and then they take way too much cash out of the business to celebrate. So getting them to take a consistent wage is a really big part of the distortions. It depends on the stage of growth in terms of what that next problem is. So I really try and customize it based on what they're struggling with at the time.
Now, we'll take a little bit of a side tangent and we'll come back to the kind of phases of growth. But, we talked about some of these issues that I think make P&Ls a lot harder for people to read when they're in the early stages, or perhaps when they're just working with more of a generalist or a tax-focused accountant. And this is top of mind for me because, I mean, we deal with this all the time at Parakeeto, but we have a particularly bad case that we're working through at the time of this recording of, you know, a client that's coming in and we're trying to decipher how has their business actually performed over the last 2 years. And because their books have only ever really been set up and used by a tax-focused accountant, they're not designed to tell them that. They're designed to minimize the amount of taxes that they're going to pay. And so things like how much did the owners actually get paid, it are actually very, very difficult for us to answer. There's all kinds of personal expenses being run through the business. And all of this is taking a ton of time and energy to restructure. And to me, this seems really problematic. So, you know, talk about what some of those kind of fundamentals are when it comes to structuring a financial system so that you can get the managerial insight first, and then, you know, still get the tax compliant, but do that without it coming at such a cost in terms of insight.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I see this a hell of a lot as well. The first thing I do is actually talk about where, big picture, where we want to go with the business. And often the founders will want to sell it at the end of the day, further down the line, they'll have to exit. And I always plant that seed at the start to say, if all you've got is your tax adjusted P&L to show a potential buyer, you're not going to be worth very much. No one wants to see those numbers. Like, that's, you made barely a profit. Well done. Congratulations. You minimized your taxes, but that's not a sellable business. You're not building an asset to sell. So I planned that in their head to realize, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, there's two ways to look at a business. There's the tax numbers, and then there's actually the operational numbers, which a potential buyer might look at. So that helps them start to see that, hey, there's two different ways to look at it. And that's essentially how it works. You've got your operational numbers and you've got your tax numbers. What I do tactically is I try and quarantine all of those other expenses, let's call them gray area expenses that might be running through the business that may or may not be operationally focused. And I put them all the way down the bottom of the P&L under other revenue expenses. I'll also throw any tax adjustments down there as well to try and get basically a true operational number, like an operational profit number above that. What we put down the bottom of that P&L is depends on where they've been coding these things. And, you know, it depends on the history of it. But generally, I try and quarantine them from a chart of accounts level down the bottom and just strip out to have a look at what our operational profit number is. The other thing you need to think about is movements on the balance sheet. So I'll be looking at their owner drawings number. So sometimes to really hit home how much cash they're taking out of their business or treating it like a piggy bank, I'll include the movement in that owner drawings number on the management wage on the P&L to show them just how much cash this business needs to produce for them to be able to take out that number. And that kind of helps start hitting home the two ways to look at a business, and that may not be as successful as they think, and they need to actually start thinking a bit more lean.
Yeah. It's such a simple idea, and one that, you know, I had a big dialogue on LinkedIn recently with a whole bunch of accountants about this very thing. And it's so simple, and yet it's so few people are doing it. So if you're listening to this, I would encourage you to, if nothing else, just take charge of your chart of accounts, the way that your financials are structured, prioritize the managerial insight, and really try to create some guardrails, to Michael's point, around these tax adjustments that are being made so that they're not so hard to decipher from what is like really going on in the business, and that you don't have to spend hours in a spreadsheet figuring out how did things actually go. Because yeah, to your point, Mike, like that happens once a year. It is, yeah. And therefore it shouldn't hamstring us from understanding what's happening in the business the other 11 months out of the year.
And also the third layer of that is actually the cash movements through the business. So there's like the story we're telling the government, the actual operational numbers, but then actually where's the cash? There's like three tiers of this that founders need to understand. So I can get it. It can be confusing.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, there's a whole, I mean, okay, like let's just go there because this is the Agency Profit Podcast and we like to get nerdy. That's a really great point. And this is a whole other thing, right? It's the cash versus accrual accounting. And then there's the added complexity of, you know, the way that most accountants are doing accruals for agencies still isn't really how they should be doing accruals. They're doing it based on invoice schedules, which is like just another version of cash accounting in my view, because the invoice schedule is rarely actually congruent with how revenue is being earned. And so if you run a firm that, like a video firm would be a great example of this. I'm sure you saw this all kinds where you have these massive movements of cash that are happening completely out of line with when revenue is being earned and when costs are being incurred. So the cash books look ridiculous. You make an insane profit one month, you lose a bazillion dollars the next month, you know, and then the final payment comes in at the end and it looks great. So on an accrual basis, you really have to be quite deliberate about how you model revenue being earned. And the most advanced way or the most accurate way to do that would be based on percent complete, but that adds quite a bit of complexity potentially to the accounting workflow. And so to your point, those things can all look very, very different. How do you think about accruals for agencies and kind of how sophisticated to get in that, understanding that something like QuickBooks typically doesn't handle, you know, percentage-based accruals very well?
Yeah. They might need to plug in a separate piece of software to help with that. People with more project-based work, and maybe they have like percentage complete and they bill at those kind of certain key points, makes it a little bit easier. For any solution, I try and tailor it to what stage of growth that client's at. If they have like a full-time bookkeeper that we can add to their list and they can actually keep on top of this, then maybe that effort is worth it. If I'm just having a monthly call where we're reviewing the numbers together and we're just relying on last month's numbers, maybe that level of complexity isn't going to be super valuable to them. It might just confuse them. So it really does depend on the founder I'm working with and how much complexity is too much. And like, what's back to first principles? What are we trying to do? What info do we need to look at to help us get there? So it's kind of that's not a one size fits all. It kind of depends on the person.
It's a good answer and it makes perfect sense. And this isn't what you're getting at, but it's a point that I'll make, I guess, because I can. This is a big part of the reason why I really think that it is not a great idea to exclusively rely on financial data, especially when you're small, to tell you how the business is performing. Because if you're not that big and you don't have that many resources, you probably can't afford to create a set of financials that are timely enough and accurate enough to be very, like, very, very helpful. And so it behooves you to have some other insights that you're looking at operationally that can help you fill in those gaps. And I'd imagine that you're not in complete disagreement with that, despite being, you know, focused on more of the financial side.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's generally where my conversations go with clients is once we understand the numbers, that's great. It's actually about how do we pull those levers. And when I first started 5 years ago in full-time advisory, I thought I'd kind of solve the problem. I was like, here's your P&L. You need to be more profitable. And they're like, yeah, but how? And I was like, yeah, good question.
Great question. Yeah, let's talk about that.
And that's been the past 5 years of work is how do we move those levers? And that's a huge part of, I think, the problem that you solve and why I follow your work and love your work is that you are purely focused on how do we pull those levers and how do we improve this performance? And that's where you need to get into the weeds with team structure, billing, all that kind of stuff to make sure that that model, that engine is working. And then from a macro perspective, the balance is there on the P&L and everything's kind of in a kind of generally a good range in terms of percentage to revenue and make sure that just that big picture stuff works. And then you fine tune the engine room.
Yeah. Excellent. And so to that point, we're going to now zoom into those stages of growth and some of the things to be paying attention to in order to get the right results as companies grow. You mentioned the ebook earlier. I'll have that in the show notes. So if you're listening and you want to check that out, just scroll down. It'll be right there. So with that, Michael, what is the kind of first key stage of growth that you see companies struggle to get through?
So, I mean, the launch stage, bootstrapping, and that's more finding your product market fit and just getting a product to market and being able to sell it consistently. So that's up to kind of the $500,000 revenue range. I don't work with a lot of founders in that space, but people who I think have growth potential, I will kind of try and help push them up above that $500,000. And that's generally when they've got a product that works and they may have built a small team. The next kind of three stages is what I focus on, which is growth, scale, established in the ebook. That's what they're called, but it's kind of basically moved from $500,000 up to $4 million and pushing to $5 million. And the big picture problem is managing those drops in profitability as you're navigating this growth curve and how you deal with those drops in profitability and how you can kind of come through the other side is really dependent on knowing what your margins are, knowing what your business model is, and having the discipline to set aside enough cash reserves for this journey up the growth curve. Because the number one thing I see is that people don't realize how much cash they need for this journey. And they will end up often come to me. The easiest sales calls for me is someone who's got a debt with the tax office here in Australia because they've spent all their money and they think they're doing really well. And they've got this huge quarterly bill and they're like, wait a minute, we have no idea what the cash movements in our business are. We need you to help navigate this with us, and helping people navigate that growth curve, fix their margins for the journey, and then think about building real growth at the end and building themselves out and what makes a valuable business, what does a buyer look like, and trying to get them to think a bit more strategically.
Do you want some free resources to help you measure and improve your profitability? If you do, then I want to tell you about our agency profitability toolkit, which you can grab absolutely free in the show notes or by heading to paraquito.com/toolkit. It's packed with training videos, cheat sheets, templates, and all kinds of other great resources to help you start measuring and improving the essential metrics that are going to drive better profitability in your business. And it's helped thousands of other agencies around the world do the same. So I want to encourage you to go and grab a copy of that. And if you'd rather get in the fast lane and just have our team of experts guide you through the process of measuring and improving your profitability, then I want to encourage you to apply for a consultation at parakeeto.com. And with that, I want to thank you again for tuning in. I hope you enjoy the episode and I'll let you get back to it. I'm really excited to dig into this because it's something I don't think enough people are thinking about. And you see evidence of businesses that do understand this and businesses that don't, and the result that not having a good handle on this stuff has. And it all reminds me of something a mentor of mine once told me. He asked me this weird question. He said, "Do you know what the sound of growth is?" I said, "It's a weird question. What does growth sound like?" And he said, it's the sound of cash being sucked out of your business at an alarming rate. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty accurate. Like growth is, it is very cash intensive. It requires a lot of cash. And I think the mistake that I've seen a lot of startups make, I mean, this is what happened to WeWork and it's what happened to Adam Neumann's most recent company, is they're growing and they're able to get the debt or the equity financing to capitalize that growth. But underneath that, they didn't actually understand their unit economics, and the unit economics weren't there. And that's the difference between a company like Amazon that runs a loss for 20 years and then 1 year decides we're going to make $1 billion in profit and just turns it on, and a company like WeWork that gets to scale, and then all of a sudden everybody realizes, oh shit, we don't actually know how to make money. The unit economics aren't there. And growing quickly and navigating cash and perhaps leveraging debt, those are two very different pictures when you understand the fundamentals of the business and you know that they're sound and these are deliberate choices, versus when you're just kind of reacting to, oh, we have more demand, we need to hire people. And then you kind of start to get into this dangerous spiral that can really put the business underground in a really bad way. So with all of that, you mentioned you had your first stage, which is finding product market fit. What happens after that and what's important to focus on there?
Yeah, so once you've got product market fit and you know what your unit economics are, so the founder's paying himself a market-based wage from the business and that we have a P&L we know we can rely on. The next stage of that is managing the cash flow issues as you grow. As you say, at a really simple level, people need to spend money today in order to invest for growth, but that dollar won't be paid back for months down the line. And so there's a huge gap between when you spend that dollar, whether that's hiring a team member who will eventually become trained and profitable and pay you back in a few months' time, or hiring that bigger office space that eventually will be filled with more staff who are billable. But there's a time lag between these investments and actually when their payoff is, and you need to have cash to help you ride through that period of growth. So that's at a really basic level where I think people struggle to, and also that they're not putting the right bets on the table. They're not actually investing in things that are going to have a good ROI. So they might be, I've seen people, you know, get a lot of kind of stars in their eyes around investing in all types of coaching programs and all these things that they think are going to move the needle, retreats and stuff. And you're like, this isn't going to pay back for your business. This is like a nice to have. A little bit of business ego creeps in where you want the nice things because you're kind of at a decent, you've got a budget to spend. So staying really laser focused on what we're spending the money on, what the return on investment is, how far are we in the future is that, and making sure we can get from this point to that in a really clear strategic way.
I think that one of the things that you touched on here a little bit as well is this idea that, yeah, you're borrowing from the bottom line today to invest in, or really you're placing a bet on having more of a bottom line later because you're going to have a larger scale. And one of the things that you kind of alluded to was this kind of concept of the model of the business, which is going to be very different in a period of growth from the actual financial performance, from the cash moves into the business. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think that's an important distinction. And you know, one way of looking at that would be like, what is the theoretical contribution margin, as you might call it in accounting terms, or direct margin, as we would call it, of the work that we're doing? And it's like, is that sound? So that I'm not quite as concerned that our gross margin is lower on the P&L because, yeah, I staffed up. And it's going to take us a little while to get that team utilized. Let's dig into that, because I think it's important to differentiate those concepts.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that I try and do that is to break it down. I speak about this in the ebook. We break it down into pods, so really easily to understand units within the business. That might be a department might have multiple smaller ones within their department, and it's getting super laser focused on what the outputs for that little pod are. and are they profitable on their own? And then we just stack them up and we make sure that they're all working together and we see which ones are underperforming, which ones are doing really well, who can we learn from and apply that knowledge. And I took this concept from a really, really cool client of mine a few years back. They've now, we actually ended up selling their business and they had a great exit. And I thought they were really, really good with how they helped break down the expectations for their team, how they put on the board the scorecards, and they were really open and honest with what was going to drive performance and let the team members help improve the performance of the business. And they were using this kind of pod strategy that I've now applied to all my clients because I think it makes it a little bit less overwhelming. Instead of having $150,000 wage bill on your P&L, it's like, what's that made up of? Who are the high performers? Who are the low performers? Who can we learn from? And try and really focus on a smaller unit basis.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to add to that, like I think the idea of breaking things down into pods makes it a lot easier to understand, to your point. You know, it's one thing to understand the direct margin or the contribution margin on a certain type of work. Like when we sell a website, you know, generally if we price it this way, we expect to make, let's say, a 70% direct margin on this. And then there's kind of level below that, which is a pod, which is what you're talking about, which is like, okay, theoretically, if we put this team together, they can handle this much revenue. They're going to have this much payroll. You know, we're going to have kind of a contribution margin or a margin on that team of this. And so as I build that up, that's what I can kind of expect that productivity to get to. And differentiating that from, you know, what's our gross margin been on the P&L, which to your point earlier, like is going to experience dips as we start to get out ahead of our skis. And the faster you grow, usually the further out ahead of that growth you need to start investing. And so you could that's where that cash strain that you're talking about it is coming from. And this is really top of mind for me because I just spoke to the team at one of the founders at Midday Squares, which is this snack company that's blowing up here in Canada. And you know, when you talk about manufacturing a food product like that, I mean, they went and spent $4 million on a production facility that could produce, you know, 10 times or 100 times more than they were selling at that time. And so that's just an extreme example of what it means to invest way out ahead and then have the confidence that it's like, okay, but it's fine because when we get up to our target utilization rate, we know that our margins on the product itself will be fine and that the P&L will eventually look better. But if you don't have that differentiation, that clarity, you might just feel like you're failing the whole time that you're trying to build the business back up, which would be a terrifying experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many risky business models like that, like cafes and restaurants as well. They have these huge fit out costs up front. So their break even point is like months or years into the future. It like, as an accountant, that kind of, I really respect the founders that do that because it's a huge amount of risk. You got to sell a lot of stakes to pay for that fit out, you know, in 1.5 years time. And I just wanted to touch on the team and the pod thing a little bit. And one of the key things that I think restrict people on this growth journey is having the right team, the right people in the right seats. And clients that I've worked with that keep kind of hitting this ceiling, maybe it's like the $1 million mark, sometimes it's like $2 million mark, but there seems to be a point where they've got a great sales pitch and they can land new clients, but their churn starts to chip up and that they seem to be stuck in this kind of leaking too many clients in order to not be able to grow that well. And it seems to be to do with either staff are leaving, that the processes start to break. So there's that bigger operational piece that eventually needs to be kind of focused on in order to help them get to that next level. And that often involves the founder leveling up their mindset, leveling up their leadership. So there's lots of other, not just like pure numbers stacking the pods. It's like, actually there's a huge growth journey for the founder in order to lead those bigger teams and to grow into a bigger position, because often they'll be the bottleneck for a lot of this stuff.
Well, and this is why I think you're totally right, right? And this is why I think it's so important that we just figure out the numbers early. And I'm sure you see this all the time, right? The founder that gets to that point, now they've got so much work coming in, they need to start hiring people, but that's the moment they realize, I haven't been valuing my time at the rate that it would cost me to buy it back. My pricing doesn't have enough margin in it if I hire other people to do it. So now they have like two really significant problems to fix. The first is actually fixing their business model from an economic perspective so they're able to afford hiring people. And then regardless, now you have to deal with all of these non-trivial, really difficult things of you know, leadership and hiring and training and onboarding and employee retention and client, and like that stuff is just gonna be hard. So let's take that whole other set of problems off the table by thinking about it a lot earlier. And on that note, I want to ask, you know, how do you think about, I think a lot of times founders are underpaying themselves early. Maybe they get themselves to a market rate salary, but then there's this dichotomy of, you know, they might have to hire people that are actually way less expensive than they are or way more expensive than they are to actually start building up their team. How do you think about modeling that as you're starting to come out of that kind of validation stage and then starting to build out the team?
Yeah, it can go either way there. And often another challenge I have is with dual founders. So we've got like to fit two market-based wages into the management labor becomes even harder. The business needs to be bigger. I try and personalize it based on what that founder's goals are. And, you know, if they've got a big fat mortgage they need to pay, we can't reduce their wage in order to hire that second in command. So we need to think about it creatively, maybe find part-time solutions and things like that. But basically the core way you do it is run a cash flow forecast, have a look at what the business would look like with that additional wage, have a look at the hit to the P&L and see if we can sustain it. And you're having all those standard conversations around what's the pipeline looking like, can we afford it, and then try and work it out from there. And I think one part of having those pods is we can work out, well, can that new hire do a little bit of work here and here and here first, do some billable time to help kind of cover their wage a little bit, and then we can build them into a management layer a little bit further down the line. So the things that I love to do is like cut down on meetings as much as possible because they're such a time suck, and make sure we're budgeting for it or quoting for it. All these hidden meetings with clients that I find actually suck management's time, and they're the most expensive person. So making sure that that's not happening, but also making sure they're doing a portion of billable work when they first start, that they're still contributing to revenue and they're not just doing non-billable stuff, because that's the biggest profitability killer.
Yep. And to add to that, I think for those, especially those that are still doing a lot of the work themselves as founders, when you're doing the analysis on pricing or on, you know, what was theoretically the contribution or direct margin from this work, model it based on what it would cost you to hire someone else to do it, as opposed to, you know, what you're paying yourself, which may or may not be even remotely representative of either what you should cost or what other people are going to cost. That way, like I said earlier, you avoid getting to this place where you're like, oh shit, I need to hire people. And then you have this realization of like, I have not at all been pricing this correctly and I cannot afford to hire people. So now I got to fix that.
Yeah, you got to go back to square one and fix your margins, make sure the model works before you can do that. I mean, so I've seen some founders say, you know what, I'm willing to take the hit. I don't have a big fat mortgage. I can kind of go small again to hire this person to buy back my time. But again, it's not really showing a true picture of what the business should be able to sustain. Ideally, you're growing as the business grows and you're hiring at that right time.
Yeah. Okay. So with that, we've talked about kind of finding product market fit and then going from, you know, 500K to, you know, it sounds like about 1 million, starting to build that initial team. What's the next phase after that and the challenges that founders face there?
Yeah. So once you've kind of built that team and you've incentivized them to stay and you've got like a decent kind of level of leadership that you can trust, that's where we start to talk about building real value or thinking like what a purchaser would look at your business and try to get them to think about what are the bigger picture things we're building here that are going to help you exit with a decent dollar in your pocket. And that's a completely different lens to what perhaps a founder, an operator will look at their business like. And that sometimes is a little bit humbling and they're like, they don't have anything documented. They have no processes documented. They have no contracts in place, maybe with their customers or their team. So it's kind of doing that boring but necessary stuff to be able to prove your story to an external buyer. And probably the big part of this is helping, the whole through line here is helping them build themselves out of their business. Whether they want to exit it or just work less of the day to day, the goals are kind of the same. And that's kind of the next stage of growth as you move towards 5 million and beyond, is kind of building them out of that business, having that leadership team, having the leadership team incentivized and kind of on board for the long term, and making sure that those processes are in place and all those kind of next level things that businesses think about.
This is really interesting because, you know, earlier you talked about something that was really important, which was this problem that having tax-focused books can create when you go to exit, which is that, you know, all of these things that really should be added back to the profitability of the business for the purpose of creating a valuation are now really difficult to sort through, especially if you're trying to go, you know, 2-3 years back and kind of work through all of it. And so assuming you have the managerial accounts, that's already made easier. But now if we start to focus on equity value of the business, it changes the conversation around investment quite a bit as well, because then you can start to think about stuff like, oh, let's update our website, or let's bring in, you know, a financial consultant to really get our financial systems dialed in, which is going to help us have a smoother transaction or increase our exit value. And those one-time expenses often, if you make them the right way, can be considered an add back or a non-recurring or not like an operationally necessary expense to the business. And so those investments start to kind of move on to, I don't want to call it the balance sheet, but almost like this equity value balance sheet. And it really can change the way that you frame where cash is going in the business as you start to target an exit. In your experience, what are some of the different ways in which shifting that lens has kind of had to open the aperture of founders and change the way that they're looking at things or the conversations that you're having?
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's going from the tax minimization focus into profits isn't necessarily a bad thing. And that shows that this business can do it into the future. So completely shifting their lens with how they look at the business and what they're optimizing for, rather than trying to minimize paying taxes. They're like, you know what? We do actually need to pay a few, because this is a sign of a healthy business, and helping them understand that. And as you said, some of those investments are a little bit more longer term, and they start to feel more confident making them at those higher revenue levels. Like you said, investing in the financial systems or whatever the business may need at that stage, thinking at them as an investment. And sometimes the ROI isn't necessarily going to be a revenue generating one in 2 months, but if it improves your enterprise value on sale, then that becomes a huge leverage point. And often the founders that I've worked with, like, there's a game of business out there, right? And businesses buyers, there's an information asymmetry between them. They're looking for a bargain. They're looking for a founder who doesn't know what they have, just like any market, right? And so I'm trying to word up all the founders, like, hey, this is how the big boys look at your business. This is what they think is valuable. You need to reverse engineer that now in order to get a value or a number that you think will be worthwhile, because, you know, everyone wants a bargain and everyone will beat you down during the negotiation if you don't have all these things in place. So think about it ahead of time. And often it'll take 12 months to slowly build all of these things, you know, build your data room and actually have all these things in place so you don't get haggled down on price further down the line.
Yeah. Yeah. That is like a classic, especially if you're dealing with someone sophisticated, like a private equity buyer. Such a classic move where they draw you in, you sign, you know, the LOI, the non-disclosure, you kind of get, and then they drag you through diligence until you're weak. And then they're like, oh, we found some skeletons in the closet. We'll give you 20% less than this, or, you know, you're going to have to hold paper on this, or we're going to change the terms so that you get way less cash and you have to roll a bunch in. And, you know, once they kind of walk you out onto the ledge, then you're screwed. And I've seen it happen time and time and time again. And so that preparation goes a long way to making sure you don't end up resentful at the end of that exit process, which is laborious enough as it is.
Yeah. And it's emotionally exhausting. And they know that. And that's part of the game that they're playing. But that's why I think there's a dual goal here. If you have a business that you cannot work in the day-to-day, that's kind of just a cash cow, you can look after the team if you need it, that's a fantastic asset to own for the long term anyway. And if someone comes along with the right price, maybe you'll talk to them. So it's kind of a win-win.
Excellent. So with all of that, Michael, any final words of advice for our listeners that are finding themselves on that journey that you want to leave them with today?
I think just pick one thing that you think your business needs right now. And often I find this is what my best work is with my clients, is just helping them prioritize what's that one thing that's really going to move the needle. Often we have so many different things to work on. Just work out which one's actually going to move the needle and focus on that first and try and fix it, because it's an overwhelming game. People get pulled in all different directions. So just having a little bit of perspective, especially around the start of a year, I'm doing it a lot with clients planning for this year ahead, working out at the end of this year, what's the steps we can take that are really going to move the needle for us, and just focus on that in priority order and not getting too pulled in all directions. I feel like that's something I see really commonly with founders, and it's a reason why a lot of people get stuck.
Good advice. And so with that, Michael, for those that are listening that want to consume more of your content and follow you online, where should we send them in the show notes?
So I post videos regularly on LinkedIn. My name is Michael Wark, W-A-R-K, and my website is trimline.co. And so you can hit me up there as well.
Yeah, some good resources on the website, some good blog articles, and we'll also have a link to the ebook that you mentioned earlier. So with all of that, Michael, thank you for joining us today and being on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you've ever found yourself thinking, man, I get so much value from this podcast, I wish there was something I could do to return the favor. Well, today's your lucky day because you can leave us a review wherever you're listening to this, and it is incredibly helpful. Of course, if you haven't grabbed a free copy of the Agency Profit Toolkit, go and get that. It's got tons of free resources to help you improve your profitability. If you're looking to get in the fast lane and get help from experts to improve your profitability and measure your most important metrics, then apply for a consultation at parakeeto.com. We'd love to chat with you and figure out how we can help. With all of that, thank you so much for being a listener, and we will see you on the next episode.